since commercially obsolete. This creation also enables the production and manipulation of hundreds of thousands of horsepower, bringing instruments on any point of the globe into action regardless of their distance from the transmitter.
Instruments?
Telegraph keys, phones, clocks, remote photography.
You have a wireless means for transmitting pictures?
Morgan rebounded, raising his eyebrows.
There is nothing novel in telephotography. Edison has been working on it since Elisha Gray's device was presented at the 1893 exposition. My patents simply usurp the need for using wires.
Don't push my tolerance, Mr. Tesla. Your proposal, as far as I understand, only deals with telegraphy. I'm a simple man who wants a way to signal incoming steamers during times of fog, to send messages to Europe, maybe get Wall Street prices when I'm in England. Can you do this? Can you send wireless messages such long distances?
Indeed I can, Mr. Morgan.
And the problem of billing. Wouldn't anyone with a receiver have free access to this information? I'm not about to subsidize my competitors, or the public, for that matter.
I can guarantee absolute privacy for all messages. Broad rights have been secured, which gives me a monopoly in the States and most of Europe.
How broad are your costs?
Although this work concerns a decade of effort, I know that I'm in the presence of a great philanthropist, and therefore do not hesitate to leave the apportionment of my interest and compensation entirely to your generosity.
Don't flatter me, Mr. Tesla. Let's get down to brass tacks. What will it cost?
My plan requires two transmitting towers, one to transmit across the Atlantic and the other across the Pacific. The former would require an expenditure of approximately $100,000. The latter, about $250,000.
Let's talk about one ocean at a time. What would I get for funding the construction of a wireless plant to cross the Atlantic?
Its working capacity would equal at least four of the present ocean cables, and it would take 6 to 8 months to complete.
What about Marconi? Stetson says his costs are 1/7 of your quote.
That is so. However, there are key elements missing for his success, elements which can only be found in my patents, an apparatus universally identified with my name and published in writings dating back to 1890 and 1893, when Marconi was still pulling his mother's apron strings.
He transmitted 1,400 words from ship to shore, right here in New York during last year's America's Cup races. I know. I was there. I saw his equipment.
Mere child's play. He is using equipment designed by others, and also the wrong frequency. The slightest changes in weather will disrupt his messages, and he has no device for creating separate channels. I have tested his Hertzian frequencies at length, Mr. Morgan, and believe there is no commercial viability in them whatsoever.
Why exactly are they so wrong?
For example, they do not make use of the natural electrical properties of the Earth. The Tesla currents, on the other hand, are tuned to the frequencies of our planet. These are continuous waves, not pulsed interruptions. In short, my way is best for transmitting substantive information and ensuring total privacy.
I have a handful of articles with Marconi's picture all over them which appear to disagree with you. The British Post Office is using the Hertzian method. Here's a newspaper report I picked up in England from an admiral who's used Marconi's transmitters for distances exceeding 80 miles. Our ship movements have been directed with an ease and certainty and carried out with a confidence which, without this wonderful extension of the range of signaling, would have been wholly unattainable. It is a veritable triumph for Signor Marconi, and I have articles which question whether you have ever sent messages beyond the confines of your laboratory.
I see that I've taken up enough of your time, the inventor said, looking at his watch. I thank you very much for your hospitality.
I'm not saying we can't do business, Mr. Tesla, but I'm going to have to think this over.
Very good. Upon Tesla's departure, Morgan took out a deck of cards and went through his nightly ritual of playing solitaire. Before him was another file on Tesla's patents, but these were not in wireless. Mr. Tesla's discoveries do away with the carbon filament. He explained that by creating an electrostatic field,
cold vacuum tubes could be hung anywhere in the room. They cannot burn out because there is no filament to be destroyed. The estimated manufacture of incandescent lamps is 50,000 a day. December 10th, 1900. Dear Mr. Morgan, appreciating the immense value of your time, I have withdrawn more or less hastily last Friday, preferring to make a few condensed statements at long distance, which, with a small effort on your part, will put you in the possession of knowledge I have gained only after a long and exhaustive study. This lengthy letter, one of the first of many, began with a quote from Professor Adolf Schlabe of Germany, who referred to Tesla as the father of this telegraphy, and also included quotes from Lord Kelvin and Sir William Crookes on other developments in the field, such as in the construction of his oscillator for generating wireless frequencies. The letter also pointed out Tesla's legal position, having patented all of the fundamentals of the process in America, Australia, South Africa, and Europe, and noted the specific flaws of Marconi's system, pointed out above. Apologizing for this digression, I beg you to bear in mind that my patents in this still virgin field, should you take hold of them, will command a position which, for a number of reasons, will be legally stronger than that held by those of my own discovery in power transmission by alternating currents. Tesla ended the letter with a rousing challenge. Permit me to remind you that had there been only faint-hearted and close-fisted people in the world, nothing great would ever have been done. Raphael could not have created his marvels. Columbus could not have discovered America. The Atlantic cable could not have been laid. You of all should be the man to embark on this enterprise, which will be an act of inestimable value to mankind. The First $1 Billion Trust. Perhaps the most outrageous character living in the Waldorf was the cigar-chomping robber baron and stock market manipulator John W. Betamillion Gates, co-owner of the American Steel and Wire Company. During an average day, Gates could win or lose $40,000 in a poker game, and on some occasions, the swing could be 10 times that much. Conferring with Henry Clay Frick, another Waldorf occupant and occasional poker companion, Gates helped choreograph one of the biggest deals of the century. On December the 12th, a dinner for the steel magnates was held in honor of Charles Schwab at the University Club. Sponsored by Schwab's boss, Andrew Carnegie, the attendees included J. Pierpont Morgan, Edward H. Harriman, August Belmont, Jacob Schiff, John W. Gates, and Carnegie's first manager, Henry Clay Frick. In an unrehearsed speech after the meal, with Carnegie now absent from the meeting, Schwab expounded in a clear and forthright manner on the advantages of creating a giant steel trust. After discussions, which lasted until 3 in the morning, Morgan began to realize the great benefit of Schwab's plan, and within a few months he finalized the merger, placing Schwab at the head of the new $1.4 billion steel trust, the first company ever to be capitalized at over $1 billion. Carnegie received approximately $226 million. Frick, $60 million, and Rockefeller, for his iron mines, $90 million. Gates, the gargantuan gambler, playing it like a poker hand, held out as long as possible until Morgan threatened to erect a wire company without him, and so he, too, walked away with a hefty profit. By March 1901, with the creation of the new corporation, Morgan was able to add steel to his portfolio, which at this time included electrical, shipping, mining, and power industries, as well as telephone, railroad, and insurance conglomerates. Political cartoons of the day portrayed him as an Atlas with the earth on his back, or as a Goliath towering over less powerful individuals, such as the King of England, the German Kaiser, or the President of the United States. In reaction to Morganization, anarchy started to become a viable political alternative. Furthermore, although Morgan stood for strength and stability in business, in reality, the creation of U.S. Steel was a magnificent gamble. Carnegie knew this, and thus stated, "Pierpont is not an iron master. He knows nothing about the business of making and selling steel. I managed my trade with him so that I was paid in bonds, not stocks. He will make a fizzle of the business and default in payments of the interest. I will then foreclose and get my properties back. Schwab also feared this. Within 2 years, the crafty conciliator had resigned from the firm to take charge of Bethlehem Steel, a much smaller gem that was sturdy and profitable. Thus Morgan was to have his headaches with the steel monopoly, partly because of market problems and mostly because of labor disputes, particularly a strike which nearly crippled the company. Probably the main reason why U.S. Steel succeeded was because of the invention of the automobile, which created an enormous new market. To offset the possibility of the great conglomerate folding and to raise the potential for more revenues, Morgan enlisted the famous stock manipulator James Keene to create an artificial interest. Keene bought and sold large blocks of U.S. Steel to bogus investors in order to create the illusion of bullish interest. The sham worked, and within a few weeks the New York Stock Exchange experienced the most active trading days in history. Big Steel's common stock, which had been offered on the market at 38, rose almost immediately to 55, and Pierpont Morgan became the hero of the financial world, and the principal demon of those who feared and hated monopoly. The Tesla Deal. Tesla met with Morgan in the midst of these steel negotiations in attempts to solidify a deal. At the height of Christmas season, he took a cab to Morgan's office at 23 Wall Street and handed the financier some of his specifications. "Mr. Morgan, my plan and my patents, which I offer to you, will command a position legally stronger than that held by the owners of Bell's telephone or by the holders of the patents based upon my discovery in power transmission by alternating current."
"Send me the paperwork, and I'll look it over."
"Sir, in view of the intense activity in this field, it is desirable that I should be placed without delay in a position enabling us to profit from my advanced knowledge." Morgan moved over to the window and stared down Wall Street.
"If I agree to help build your station to transmit across the Atlantic, I want it understood that I am..."
And then he turned to face the Serb and lowered his voice to barely a whisper.
"A silent partner. Do you know what that means, Mr. Tesla?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"Good. I want to be frank. I do not have a good impression of you. You abound in controversy. You're boastful. And aside from your deal with Westinghouse, you have yet to show a profit on any other creation. On the other hand, I appreciate your talents. So let me put my cards on the table. If we proceed, whatever figure we decide upon shall be firm. I will not be bilked for continuing research funds."
"It is not money I seek, although these inventions in your strong hands, with your consummate knowledge of business, can be worth an incalculable amount. You know the value of scientific advancement and artistic creation. Your terms are mine."
"That is not good enough. Give me specifics. Give me a figure."
"As I stated at our first meeting, I think $100,000 will suffice for the construction of a 90-foot-high transatlantic transmitter."
"Let me be certain on this. Shall we say $150,000 for the erection of said transmission tower, and a 50-50 split on the company's stock?"
Morgan reached for his checkbook, wrote out a down payment, and handed it to the inventor. Overawed at his good fortune and humbled in the presence of the king, Tesla could not stop himself.
Let the control be yours, Mr. Morgan. I insist that you take 51% and I 49%.
"You are a strange man indeed. All right, it's a deal. After the papers are drawn up, you may draw on the House of Morgan as the need arises for the full limit."
January 3, 1901. "My dear Colonel Astor, hearty wishes for the new century. Mr. Morgan's generous backing, for which I shall be grateful all my life, secures me my triumphs in wireless telegraphy and telephony, but I am still unable to put my completed inventions, oscillators, fluorescent lights, on the market. I can hardly believe that you, my friend since years, should hesitate to join me in introducing them when I can offer you 10 times better returns on your investment than anyone else. Yours sincerely, N. Tesla."
The fine print. March 5, 1901. "Dear Mr. Tesla, I beg to acknowledge receipt of your letter of the first instant, together with assignments of an interest in various patents, as shown upon the schedule, and assignments handed me therewith, and to confirm the understanding therein expressed. Very truly yours, J. Pierpont Morgan.
The Octopus was not content with creating a simple partnership in wireless. Unbeknownst to the inventor, Morgan wanted the lighting concern as well, and control of Tesla's patents. Boldly, these were added to the agreement. Tesla was now placed in a difficult situation, since Astor was the principal backer in the other enterprise, and the inventor had not planned to include the actual patents as part of his collateral. "When I received your formal letter," Tesla wrote 3 years later, "it specified an interest in 51% in patents on these inventions. That was different, though my share was the same. It was a simple sale. The terms were entirely immaterial to me, and I said nothing for fear of offending you. You have repeatedly referred to some stock, and it is just possible that a mistake was made." Rather than confronting his new benefactor head-on, Tesla acquiesced. February 18, 1901. "Dear Mr. Stedlick," Morgan's intermediary, "I need scarcely say that I would sign any document approved by Mr. Morgan, but believe that there exists a misunderstanding in regards to my system of lighting which was not included in the original proposition. Rather than try to amend the agreement to remove this vital concern, which, in Tesla's words in the same letter, will create an industrial revolution, the inventor pointed out the great advantages of the lighting venture and included a promotional announcement entitled Tesla's Artificial Daylight. He concluded by stating that, besides myself, Colonel Astor is interested. Thus it will be necessary for me to comply with a formality before making the assignments. I shall attend to this matter at the earliest possible moment." A month before, perhaps in anticipation of this problem, Tesla had appealed once again to his original benefactor. January 11, 1901. "My dear Colonel Astor, since Mr. Adams and his associates are entirely out, I have practically nobody but you and Mr. Morgan with me. Please let me hear from you. With me you are not with some wild syndicate, but with a man to whom your name, credit, and interest are sacred." Astor called on the telephone a week later. He told the inventor that he was concerned that Tesla did not have fundamental patents and that other inventors might have priority, particularly on the wireless enterprise. "Do not be misled by what the papers say, Colonel. I have the controlling rights. Why not come in with Mr. Morgan and myself?" Astor avoided making any definitive statements, and so Tesla apparently simply attached the lighting concern to the wireless deal with the Commodore. Now Morgan controlled the fundamentals behind two completely independent new industries. Tesla could hardly complain. He had agreed to the proposal. All he had to do was succeed with the capital now provided. March 5, 1901. "Dear Mr. Steele," another Morgan intermediary, "now that all dangers of conveying a wrong impression to Mr. Morgan is removed by his kind acceptance of my proposal, I would call to his attention that I consider my fundamental patents on methods and apparatus for the wireless transmission of energy as the most valuable patents of modern times, and as to my system of lighting, I am convinced that it constitutes one of the most important advances and is of enormous commercial value. Yours sincerely, N. Tesla." On the 13th of the month, always a favored day for the superstitious wizard, Tesla paid Westinghouse back a note for $3,045. He was out of debt and on his way.
30. World Telegraphy Center, 1901.
"Dear Mr. Morgan, how can I begin to thank you in the name of my profession and my own, great, generous man? My work will proclaim loudly your name to the world. You will soon see that not only am I capable of appreciating deeply the nobility of your action, but also of making your primarily philanthropic investment worth 100 times the sum you have put at my disposal in such a magnanimous and princely way. With many, many wishes from all my heart for your happiness and welfare, believe me, ever yours most faithfully, N. Tesler. In March 1900, there was a fire in the East Houston Street building that housed Tesla's laboratory. The Jews on the lower floor were burned out, and this frightened me nearly to death, Tesla wrote the Johnsons. It was a close shave, and if the misfortune had happened, it would have been probably the last of your friend Nikola. Throughout this period, the onslaught by the press also continued in an unbridled fashion. February 25, 1901. My dear Mr. Tesla, we never forget old friends and defend them against all malicious assailants at all hazards. Yours truly, Ernest Heinrich. One of the old guard from the Westinghouse Corporation, Heinrich included a newspaper clipping which he had written. Anyone who is ignorant, Heinrich wrote, does not know that Tesla stands in the front rank of electrical inventors by what he has actually accomplished. Another who came to Tesla's defense was T.C. Martin, who authored a word of praise in Science. The ship was off its course, Tesla wrote, but I always had faith in the captain. December 13th, 1900. My dear Tesla, I am delighted to get your kind favor of December 12th. I know of no change whatever in my sentiments towards you these many years from the beginning until now. I shall always be very proud of my modest association with your earlier work. As ever, T.C. Martin. Unfortunately, there was also bickering between Tesla and Martin about the previous editorial attacking Tesla in Martin's journal and about Tesla's slow progress on his other inventions. Concerning the vacuum lamps, Martin wrote, I should be delighted to see you or any other man give us the commercial art. Perturbed, Tesla cut off his correspondence, and so the friendship remained impaired. Just 3 months later, in March 1901, Tesla invited an admirer and disciple of Swami Vivekananda, Miss Emma C. Thursby, to his laboratory. My light will then be permanently installed, and you and your friends, Miss Farmer in particular, will be most welcome to see it. Tesla's New Surprise. Julian Hawthorne. Great preparations for an experiment upon a stupendous scale are being made at the Wizard's Laboratory on East Houston Street. An unannounced visitor gained entrance today by chance. Tesla was not there, but what the visitor saw chained him to the spot. A wonderful color. From a stout beam from the ceiling hung three dazzling, pulsating clots of purple-violet light. The room glowed with the warmth of a strange, unearthly rich color, a hue that is not listed in the spectrum. Above and below the beams twisted long glass spirals closely coiled, snakes of beating violet flame. Sudden darkness. One of Tesla's workmen found the unannounced visitor spellbound. A quick spring to the wall, a concealed button touched, and darkness. Those who know say that this violet light is the wizard Tesla's new flash signal to the Martians. He will reveal it to the world soon. It is even hinted around the corner of Mulberry Street at police headquarters that Tesla has already wigwagged the red planet and had a response. Hawthorne was living in Yonkers and often took a train down to Manhattan, dining with Tesla at the beginning of the year. They shared a number of common friends, including Stanford White, whose father, Richard Grant White, had confessed to Hawthorne once, among other sacred confidences, of a woman whom he had found and loved in New York. The rumor, in essence, was that he had been essentially a bigamist, maintaining one home for his family and one for his concubine. Perhaps this explained Stanley's penchant for philandering. The son, however, easily surpassed the father, as he was able to maintain 5 or 6 retreats, including an estate on Long Island, an apartment in Gramercy Park, the Garden Tower Suite, the morgue on West 55th Street, which he and his compatriots like Saint Gaudens used in a pinch, and his most infamous haunt at 22 West 24th Street. In March, Stanford became smitten by the exotic charms of the 16-year-old Floradora siren Evelyn Nesbitt, who had been featured as a Gibson centerfold for Collier's and as a nearly bare-breasted Spanish dancer in a popular musical on Broadway. White watched her perform night after night for many weeks before he was able to arrange a rendezvous, which first took place in the heat of summer at the 24th Street studio. Stanford had me put in an electric door, the inventor told Hawthorne. You press a button, and it automatically opens. White had decorated his bachelor den in shades of red, with velvet curtains on the windows, soft cushions on the floor, and tapestries, statues, and paintings, mostly nudes, all around. In his loft, with the room set like a small forest, lit with a bright skylight, could be found a red velvet swing hanging from the ceiling, like one of Chaucer's toys, with green ropes trailing down from the seat like vines from a tree. Besides meeting with the mystical son of the renowned Gothic author Nathaniel Hawthorne, Tesla dined with Stanford White and sometimes Mark Twain at the Players Club, or with Spanish-American war hero Richmond Hobson, Rudyard Kipling, or, of course, the Johnsons, throughout this period. Catherine was caught up in her interest in spiritualism and tried an experiment in thought transference without the inventor knowing. In jest, Tesla wrote back, My dear Mrs. Johnson, there was no telepathic influence this time. I never thought of you even for a moment. Sincerely, Millionaire Kid. Rooted in his materialistic philosophy, the superstitious wizard who talks with other worlds continued to repudiate the notion that human minds could interact by extrasensory means, even though he had recently saved some friends from a train wreck because of a premonition. Overtly, however, he would maintain that psychic phenomena was poppycock. Catherine would not only be teased for her mystical bent, but also over possession of Hobson and over her looks. My dear Luca, when Mrs. Philipoff is out of town, I think of Mrs. Decay as the most charming lady of my experience. It would be advisable, Luca, to keep both ladies in ignorance of this. A word to the wise is sufficient. Considered much like an uncle to the family, Tesla also expressed his continuing affection for the Johnson children. For Agnes, he would sign a New Year's card, Nicola Hobson, and for Owen, he took the time to read the youngster's first novel, The Arrow of the Almighty. He also congratulated Owen on his impending marriage. Agnes would also later marry, and she would inherit the vast Johnson correspondence, much of which was donated to Columbia University. According to the present Mrs. Robert Underwood Johnson, the wife of Owen's son, named after the grandfather, Agnes was awful. I didn't like her at all. Her daughter, however, was very beautiful. Paderewski felt that Anne had great talent. Owen was dashing and attractive and had a lot of his mother's qualities. As a writer, he authored the Lawrenceville series and made a good living as a novelist. The present Mrs. Johnson stated that Catherine had an Irish personality. She could be gay and lively and fun-loving, but also depressive underneath. The present Robert Underwood Johnson lived with his grandparents. They had two Irish servants, Josie and Nora. Catherine would go into one of her moods and just stay in her room and wouldn't come down even for meals. Her depression became more severe after World War I. She said that Robert was considered to be boring, very formal, with old-world manners, a fine old gentleman. Catherine was attracted to Tesla because he was imaginative and exciting from a European point of view. He might have brought more gaiety into the house. Wardenclyffe. Inventor Nikola Tesla has purchased a 200-acre tract at Wardenclyffe on the Sound, 9 miles east of Port Jefferson, for the establishment of a wireless telegraphy plant. The land and improvements will cost $150,000. On March 1, 1901, Tesla officially signed his contract with Morgan. He was now able to begin construction of his laboratory and tower on Long Island, 65 miles from New York City. 2 days later, Morgan officially announced the creation of U.S. Steel. No such announcement was made about the Tesla Company. The above article, which appeared in a local paper, the Long Island Democrat, was perhaps the only one to make reference to the correct figure of $150,000 which Morgan provided. When John O'Neill wrote his biography in 1944, he did not know the details of the Morgan-Tesla relationship, even though he had personally known Tesla for over 30 years. The inventor, whose papers were still under lock and key at the time of the completion of the biography, had told O'Neill that the financier provided the funds in his capacity as a philanthropist, although